This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and in today's program, we take a close look at the Obama administration's assassination program. We'll be speaking with Nate Wessler from the American Civil Liberties Union. Also today, we pay tribute to two great departed creators, one of them, the novelist Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, and also Steve Ben Israel, the poet and performance artist. All of that and more coming up today on 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the world has been recently rocked by revelations of the assassination program that is being conducted out of the White House by the Obama administration and advisory teams who come up with kill lists. There have been reports in the New York Times and many other media about this process, a global killing campaign, kill teams in the White House, targeting individuals whose deaths are sanctioned by the President of the United States. Among the institutions concerned about this process is the American Civil Liberties Union. And we're now joined live by Nate Wessler from the National Security Program of the ACLU. Welcome to 5 o'clock Shadow.
Thank you.
What is your understanding of how people are extrajudicially deprived of life under the current operation of the Obama administration?
Well, we know a number of facts and details about these programs from extensive reporting in the press, including this very detailed New York Times article that was recently published. We know that both the military and the Central Intelligence Agency maintain so-called kill lists of suspected terrorists or militants that they claim the authority to track down and kill, and that both of them use unmanned drones, armed drones, as well as other means to then carry out these targeted killings. In addition to killing people on the lists, there are also targeted killing strikes that some in the administration have apparently referred to as, quote, signature strikes. And those target not named individuals, but groups of people who intelligence analysts believe are exhibiting behaviors that mark them as likely militants. So it's yet another step removed from even whatever deliberative process there is, secret deliberative process inside the administration to put people on these lists.
Nate, the term militant and the term terrorist, these are such broad terms, and the characterization of an individual as being militant may not necessarily imply unlawful conduct. Are you at the ACLU concerned about the lack of judicial review or redress about people being put on these death lists?
Very concerned. The Attorney General, several weeks ago in a speech at a law school in Chicago, made the really stunning claim that although, just talking about U.S. citizens who are put in these kill lists, although U.S. citizens do enjoy the protections of the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment right against being deprived of one's life without due process of law, he made the stunning claim that due process does not equal judicial process, and that a closed, secret, bureaucratic process inside the White House and inside the executive branch should be plenty due process for anybody who is deemed to be killable and then killed. We think that is deeply problematic. It's counter to the law of this country, to the Constitution. When the United States government deliberatively tracks down and kills somebody, whether they believe that that person is a militant or a terrorist or some other designation, the courts must have a role in assessing whether that killing is justified. You know, that's what happens certainly inside the United States when the police draw a weapon and fire and kill somebody who they may or may not believe was posing an imminent threat to somebody else. Courts have a role in taking a look at what happened and assessing whether, in fact, the government was acting within the law. So you're absolutely right. These these designations of militant or terrorist or combatant are broad, and there are serious reasons to be concerned with whether those designations are being being lawfully and accurately applied. One of the revelations in this New York Times article was that the Obama administration is apparently counting, quote, all military-age males in a strike zone as combatants unless there's explicit posthumous evidence proving them innocent. That's a shoot first and ask questions later policy that is really just shocking if it's accurate.
It's tantamount to saying we can prove they were a terrorist because they were killed by our drone.
That's right. If you were in the place where our drone missiles hit, then you must be a terrorist because our drone missiles hit you. It's really amazingly circular and quite dangerous, and it calls into question whether the government is abiding by the international legal requirements that protect civilians and non-combatants in times of war, even assuming, as the government claims, that the laws of war authorize these kind of targeted killing attacks, which we don't accept in places like Yemen, where the U.S. is not engaged in an act of war. It's not the battlefield like Afghanistan would be.
Well, with the violation of international sovereignties with these operations, what are the international protections that are being evaded here? What does the Universal Charter of Human Rights, what does the International Court, what do even United States laws have to say about a bunch of guys getting together on Tuesday morning and deciding who to kill?
Well, there are really two broad international legal regimes that that have something to say about this topic. The first are the laws of war. So in a place where there is an armed conflict, Afghanistan certainly would be such a place, an armed conflict that the United States is involved in, then the international laws of war provide very clear and well-established protections to non-combatants and civilians. The government has an obligation to distinguish combatants from non-combatants, and to take steps to minimize the harm to civilians when it uses lethal force. Now, the United States government claims that the laws of war allow it to carry out these targeted killing strikes in places beyond traditional battlefields, beyond somewhere like Afghanistan, as far away as Yemen or even Somalia. That's a highly controversial claim, and one that we contest. Outside of a active war zone or a battlefield, it's international human rights law or domestic laws of countries that apply. And under that regime, there are very, very narrow circumstances where a government can use lethal force. It can only kill somebody if that person is posing a concrete, specific, and imminent threat to the life or safety of another person. That's a very high bar. It's the same sort of legal standard that would allow the police to shoot somebody who was holding a gun to a civilian's head on the street. There would be a narrow set of circumstances where the use of lethal force would be justified in that kind of a case. But the government's definition of when it's allowed to use lethal force appears from the public reporting to be much broader than that. And that simply is a violation of international law.
I know that your organization, the American Civil Liberties Union, has been attempting to get more clarity on the mechanics of the mechanics, attempting to retrieve information through freedom of information lawsuits. How has that progressed? How much have you gotten, and what do you hope to get?
So we have two separate Freedom of Information Act lawsuits currently in the courts. One is in the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and another is in the Federal Trial Court in New York. In the case in Washington, D.C., we're seeking records about the use of drones to conduct targeted killings by the U.S. government. And in the court in New York, we're seeking records specifically about the targeted killing of U.S. citizens by the U.S. government, including three United States citizens killed in drone strikes in Yemen last year. Now, the background to understand is that the information that we and the rest of the public have about this targeted killing program comes from many years of quite extensive reporting by members of the press who have relied on numerous statements of administration officials, many of them unnamed, many of them who asked for anonymity, but discussing in detail how the CIA and the military carry out these targeted killings using drones and other means around the world. Yet, when we've gone to court in these lawsuits, asking the CIA to release records about its targeted killing program, the government has taken the really incredible position that it can neither confirm nor deny whether the CIA operates any sort of targeted killing program or uses drones. That's completely at odds with what members of the administration, including the former director of the CIA, Leon Panetta, who's now the Secretary of Defense, and the president and others have said in public. So the administration seems to be engaged now in a campaign of selective disclosures, really a propaganda campaign, where they authorize officials, often anonymously, to provide information to the press that trumpets their perceived successes of the targeted killing program. But yet when our organization or others like the New York Times go into court seeking the actual records and the full accounting of what this program looks like, they suddenly refuse to confirm or deny whether that program exists.
Nate Wessler with the National Security Program of the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm concerned about the domestic side of this as well as the improper deprivation of life wherever it may occur on the planet. And in the case of an American citizen, who are these people who are telling the president that somebody is worthy of death? I mean, the president does not have firsthand knowledge of a situation. So he's depending on people who, in an international context, have a military grudge against the people they're targeting. And the individual who might be an American citizen certainly has no due process disclosure or recourse or appeal. I mean, when Obama decides to kill somebody, does he tweet them a message?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, there's not only does somebody who's placed on one of these kill lists not have advanced knowledge that they're at risk, but the administration really hasn't even clearly set out the criteria that it uses to put someone on that list. So it would be very hard for somebody to know whether their activities or the people they know or the place where they are spending time in Yemen or Pakistan or elsewhere is putting them at risk and is resulting in them being targeted.
Nate, here is just a scenario to try and help put this in a tangible perspective. Mumia Abu-Jamal has somehow escaped the death row with recent court rulings in Pennsylvania. And if the day were to come that he were released from prison and he went on an international tour and maybe spoke to some African people in Somalia and said words that this secret kill team did not like, then could we end up in a case where Mumia Abu-Jamal in Somalia would be executed, not by the Pennsylvania Corrections Department, but by the President of the United States?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that I could really speak to that hypothetical, but I do think that the question, you know, it raises all of the very troubling questions of what kind of evidence is the government relying on when it decides to target people? Is it relying simply on their speech, or is it actually looking for their actions? Certainly, the government does not seem to be relying on a concept of imminent threat, you know, actual impending concrete and specific threat that somebody is going to carry out an attack or do something else similar. And so there are, you know, very serious questions about what kind of intelligence and information is used to justify placement of people on a kill list or their targeting, and also you know, serious questions about whether people's mere association with individuals who the government believes are targetable marks them to die, which, according to the government's you know, definition of who is a targetable militant, unless proven otherwise, seems to be a real concern.
Nate Wessler of the American Civil Liberties Union, how much information do we have as to who has the president's ear. Who are these national security staffers, State Department people, CIA, other intelligence agencies? Who is bending the president's ear?
Well, one detail that we've learned recently from reporting from the Associated Press, as well as the New York Times and others, is that John Brennan, who's the president's chief counterterrorism advisor in the White House, has really taken on a very central role in this targeted killing program. And in the last month or month and a half, has moved to really centralize the decision-making process for who is added to these kill lists and who is authorized to be killed inside his office under his control. That's really a breathtaking amount of power for any one person to wield. In addition to him, there are dozens, up to 100 perhaps, people inside the military and national security architecture who take part in meetings where names of people are debated as to whether to place them on kill lists, and then as time passes, periodically it appears that those names are reevaluated to see whether they can stay on those kill lists. So there are a number of people who have a part in the process, but certainly the highest leadership of the military and of the Central Intelligence Agency are deeply involved in this process, in authorizing the placement of individuals on the kill list and then directing that actual missile strikes be fired at them.
Penultimate question. Is there a continuing proscription under American law or judicial procedures or executive orders that make it now possible for the president to order the assassination of a foreign head of state? I'm thinking about the bombings that were done in Libya in pursuit of the Muammar Gaddafi family. I'm thinking of similar situations in other nations that have taken place. Can the president order the killing of foreign leaders?
Well, there is still an executive order that bans assassinations, but the administration has been quite eager to create loopholes around that prohibition by defining its activities as coming under its military authority, saying that the grant of authority that Congress gave just after September 11th to retaliate against al-Qaeda or the Taliban broadly provides it with authorities to carry out these kinds of killings. So the lines have certainly been blurred. I can't speak to what the administration believes to be its current authority as the heads of state, but it is certainly a serious question, and the degree to which the ban on assassinations has appeared to weaken certainly raises those questions.
The possibility exists, at least theoretically in my mind, that the president could lateral, as in football, do a lateral play and lateral it out to the military, the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, Delta, SEAL, or some such agency, or to NATO, and claim that an attack was being made on terrorists or some such thing. And after they do this military lateral, the high-ranking target of a foreign country could be referred to as collateral damage. It would have the effect of assassination, but not the admission that that was the intent.
Well, certainly, the administration's definition of collateral damage or what's permissible collateral damage is quite broad in these cases. I mean, they have claimed, the president and John Brennan and others have claimed there have been a very small number of civilian casualties through these drone strikes, but that largely seems to hinge on the definition of civilian that they use that is quite narrow and quite restrictive, contrary to what the law really requires. So again, I think you're absolutely right that the government's playing fast and loose with these kinds of definitions allows it to undertake killings that any sound evaluation of the state of the law would deem to be illegal.
And there is no do not kill list, is there?
That's right. There's no do not kill list. The kill lists are secret, and there's no way so far to challenge someone's placement on one.
Well, Nate Wessler, you have been a revelation today. Nate is with the National Security Program at the American Civil Liberties Union. And our listeners who are concerned about these issues, where might they go to follow your and your institution's work on this?
Our website, aclu.org, has a wealth of information about our work around transparency and the substantive issues involved in these targeted killing campaigns.
Thank you once again for joining us today, Nate Wessler of the American Civil Liberties Union, and I wish you the greatest of success in the Freedom of Information lawsuits so that we might know more about these disturbing developments.
Thank you.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are commemorating two lives today, one of them Steve Ben Israel, and the other Ray Bradbury, the speculative fiction writer who died in Los Angeles, California, following a lengthy illness. He is notable for so many works, but among them, The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, and an homage to freedom. A book that was originally called The Fireman that later became known as Fahrenheit 451. And Ray Bradbury spoke a bit about his life, his work, his approach to it, in a special conversation with Lawrence Bridges, produced for the publicly funded National Endowment for the Arts. And we hear now just a bit of Ray Bradbury.
I suppose you wonder why I've called you all here. I want to identify myself. I'm Ray Bradbury. But you're very curious, aren't you, to find out how I fell in love with books. I learned to read when I was 3 years old. I loved comic strips. I loved the cartoons on Sunday. And I got a book of fairy tales when I was 5 years old. And I fell in love with reading. And when I was six, I saw a film on dinosaurs. And dinosaurs filled my life. A thing that begins when you're 3 and 6 and 10 and 12 wind up in your fictions when you're in your 30s. The things that you do should be things that you love, and things that you love should be things that you do. I was 7 years old when I went to the library for the first time, and I was hoping to find books about the Land of Oz by L. Frank Baum and Tarzan by Edgar Rice Burroughs. That was a great adventure. And I'd open the door of the library and I'd look in, and all those people were waiting for me in there. You see, libraries is people. People are waiting in there. Thousands of people who wrote the books. My greatest influences are John Steinbeck. I read The Grapes of Wrath when I was 19 years old. So you find the author who could lead you through the dark. And Shakespeare started me there. And Hamlet starred me there, and Richard III, and Emily Dickinson led the way for me, and Edgar Allan Poe said, "This way, here's the light." That's where a library is. So you go into the library and discover yourself. Long at night, when I was 12 years old, and I looked at the planet Mars, and I said, "Take me home," and the planet Mars took me home, and I never came back. So I've written every day in the last 75 years. I've never stopped writing. We should learn from history about the destruction of books. When I was 15 years old, Hitler burned books in the streets of Berlin. So I learned then how dangerous it all was. Because if you didn't have books and the ability to read, you couldn't be part of any civilization. You couldn't be part of a democracy. If you know how to read, you have a complete education about life, then you know how to vote within a democracy. But if you don't know how to read, you don't know how to decide. That's the great thing about our country, is we are a democracy of readers, and we should keep it that way. I published the first version of Fahrenheit in February 1951. When I moved into LA with my family, I had two daughters. I needed an office because my daughters were very loud and wonderful and lovely, but I had no money for an office. I was wandering around up at UCLA, and I heard typing in a room down in the basement. And I went down to the basement, and I found a room with that had 12 typewriters in it. I could rent a typewriter for 10 cents a half hour. So I said, my God, this is my office. Doesn't matter, I was surrounded by students. I got a bag of dimes. I moved into the typing room in the basement of the library, and I spent $9 and $9.80, and I wrote Fahrenheit 451. So you see, what a place for Fahrenheit 451 to be written, in the library of all places where it wasn't being burned. So I made a contract with Valentine, and I went to the library again, where with the typing in the typing room, and I added 25,000 words. How did I do that? I got the characters to come to me. Montag came and said, do you know who I am completely? I said, no. I said, tell me. And the fire chief came to me, and he told me about his prior life. I said to the fire chief, why did you burn books? And he told me. And Clarice McClellan came, who was a 16-year-old girl who was in love with books and libraries and life. Clarice is me. Clarice McClellan is Ray Bradbury, the young boy who fell in love with life. And Clarice is the essence of life and the essence of love. You see, all my characters write the book. I don't write the book. All these characters come to me and say, listen to me. And then I listen to them and I put it down and the book gets written. That's how I write, you see. All these lovers surround me and they love life and they tell me about it. At the center of my books is the gift of life. The reason why my books are popular because they know I'm a lover. When people touch my books, they are alive. So that's the gift I give to them, and I want them to carry them back and forth to the library. Books are smart and brilliant and wise. Love what you do and do what you love. Don't listen to anyone else who tells you not to do it. You do what you want, what you love. But imagination should be the center of your life. Fantasy at the center of your life. I'm going to have a t-shirt made. It says, stand at the top of the cliff and jump off and build your wings on the way down. We are all the sons and the daughters of time. So I thank the universe for making life on Earth and allowing me to come alive here.
Somebody has to do what's right. Fahrenheit 451. Red and black and white.
Fahrenheit 451, performed by Utopia from their compilation Swing to the Right, in celebration of the eponymous science fiction novel about freedom of thought by the late Ray Bradbury. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there is yet another death today, that of the legendary actor, poet, composer, philosopher, and performance artist, Steve Ben Israel. He succumbed to a long illness at his New York City home, and like his dear friend and our broadcast colleague, Bob Fass, the freeform pioneer of Radio Unnameable here on WBAI, Steve Ben Israel was also an alumnus of Judith Malina's Living Theater, a Lower East Side oasis of the acting craft. Steve was at various stages a beatnik, a hippie, a yippie, a performer, and most recently, he toured nationally with his performance piece called Nonviolent Executions. And throughout his life, his works, his acts, his wit and insights helped form so many of the memes and concepts that define contemporary American freedom, social justice, and international understanding. We spoke with Steve Ben Israel in July 2010 on the WBAI program Earthwatch, on the occasion of the death of yet another legend, the poet and composer Thule Kupferberg of the Fugs. And even though Steve was memorializing Thule, much of his praise for Kupferberg could just as well be applied to our late friend, Steve Ben Israel.
I'm Robert Knight. You're listening to WBAI. And I'm speaking with Steve Ben Israel, great performer who, like myself and the rest of us, are mourning the loss of yet another great performer in the person of Thule Kupferberg of the Fugs. Welcome to the show, Steve, once again.
Oh, you're great to be here.
How are you addressing the loss of Thule Kupferberg?
Well, you know, I was up in the hospital a couple of days ago, and he had all these tubes in him, and he was laying there, you know, and I've been at hospital beds too many times over the last many years, and I've seen beautiful cats going out. And, of course, we were always hoping that he'd come back, like the end of one of those great science fiction radio shows when I was a kid, but he didn't. So, you know, it's strange about when a guy lives to be 86, you know, you don't mourn him the same way as somebody who went out at 30, you know. So, of course, you pay homage to that whole life that he had and all the love that he gave out and how loved he was by almost everybody. Thule was like, he made you feel like he was your best friend. So you walk around with another great best friend, and you know, and he only lived two blocks away from me, and I remember 31 years ago we took our 5-year-old kids together, his and mine, and we enrolled them in kindergarten. We were a couple of weird looking freaks in this amongst the parents that were showing up depositing their children. And and, you know, and we performed many times together at Coca Crystal's New York cable show. And I, you know, sat down with many times with him over the years and on this bench on Prince Street. And we talked about all the great anarchist stuff. He asked me 2 years ago, what's the origin of that song, Nobody for President, that Wavy used to sing and guys from the Fireside Theater used to sing? But I told him it was originated by Mel Most from the IWW in 1972. So, and I remember he did it on his TV show when he gave Mel Most the...
Steve Ben Israel recently found this. And we now both believe it's the first use of the immortal phrase, nobody for president. And we're going to sing it. I'm going to sing it. Nobody for president. We don't need a king. All his powers should be ours. Let the people do their thing. And this was sung by Mel Most, an IWW Wobbly member, in 1972. I've brought it down to date, as we say, and I'm going to do the next two new verses. When will that happen? Heaven only knows. Liars fool us, idiots rule us, and sweet time is on the wing. Bum, bum, bum. Down, you old Democrats. Out, rude Republicrats. Rise, miraculous creed. Revelation. Revolution, cast your peaceful, loving seeds.
It's eerie, the parallel of thoughts, the wake of the life of Tuli Kupferberg, whether it's the thugs or his poetry or the television program and so many other things. For those who don't even know that they know of some of the consequences of his work, the thugs, and the whole ambiance that you all come out of, take a moment to tell people about who Tuli was creatively.
Well, he was a wonderful poet and a wonderful humorist, and he wrote these parasongs. And parasongs were songs that he used traditional melodies and wrote new words. For example, backwoods Jewish soldiers
strolling back from war, hug your Gentile brothers as you've done before. Presidents and premiers perish, empires rise and fall. But hearts of old compassion still might save us all. Yeshu and Kohelet plant wisdom and fresh love. Kiss the hand that helps you, blue skies still above. Backward Jewish soldiers watching from all wars. Embrace your Gentile sisters as you've done before. Kings and presidents perish, all empires fade and fall. But hearts of sweet compassion still may save us all. Yeshu and Kohelet blend wisdom and fresh love. Kiss the hand that helps you, blue skies still above. Backward Jewish soldiers strolling back from war. Hug your Gentile brothers as you've done before. Presidents and premiers perish, empires rise and fall. But hearts of old compassion still might save us all. Yeshu and Kohelet lend wisdom and fresh love. Kiss the hand that helps you, blue skies still above. Backward Jewish soldiers marching from all wars. Embrace your Gentile sisters as you've done before. Kings and presidents perish, all empires fade and fall. But hearts of sweet compassion still may save us all.
Kings and presidents perish. All empires fade and fall. But hearts of sweet compassion still may save us all.
Right? And you took a lot of great old tunes that we knew and redid them, and they were always well written and funny. And, you know, he was a tremendous artist going way back, you know, before it really happened, publishing books and reading poetry way back there in the early mid-50s. And besides, he was a great anarchist, pacifist, socialist, which I am also. And so we always agreed and talked about the history of that, you know, all the great anarchists over the last 300-400 years that made major contributions. We're always discussing them. But, you know, he was such a beautiful man. You know, that's the greatness of his poetry and his artistry, of who he was and how he came across with people.
You know, he used contradiction so well and yet hilariously, but always with a serious humanistic heart. And, for example, a lot of people might know of Thule and the Fogs from the recent Coen Brothers movie, Burn After Reading, George Clooney, which ended with his performance, his vocals on the song CIA Man.
Who can kill a general in his bed? Overthrow dictators in the red. How can a man? CIA Man. Buy a government so cheap. Change a cabinet without a squeak.
Coen Man. CIA Man.
Who can train gorillas by the dozens? Send them out to kill their untrained cousins.
Coen Man.
CIA Man. A budget that's so great. Who will be the 51st state? Who has got the secret of service? The one that makes the other service nervous. There's no Coen Man.
CIA Man.
Take the sugar from its sack. Pour in LSD and put it back.
Coen Man.
CIA Man. Who can mine the harbors, Nicaragua? Out at all the hitmen of Chicago.
Coen Man.
CIA Man. Can be so overtly covert, sometimes even covertly overt.
Coen Man.
CIA Man. Who's the agency well known to God? The one that got the stamp and got the rod.
Coen Man.
CIA Man.
Yeah.
There's also, by this contradiction I'm referring to, the song, like, say, Kill for Peace.
Right, right. I guess they couldn't use that one in the regular movie world, you know, but you know, it was such a statement that kill for peace, which is what America was doing during the Vietnam War, and that's why a song came out that kill for peace, which threw everybody. But they soon realized that's what we're doing. We're killing for peace. And that was the greatness of that moment he picked up in history, like I said, during the Vietnam War. And the wars just go on and on and on, and that song is more relevant than ever.
Well, you know, we're living for Thule also, and I trust that, you know, and will convey to the family the love and regard of this audience, this station, this constituency and community.
Yeah.
And I'm... wondering, how are the other group members feeling, you know, today?
I spoke to his wife today, and I spoke to his best friend, Thelma, yesterday. I haven't spoken to Ed or Steve and Taylor or Kobe. Have not been in touch with them lately. But, you know, I guess they'll say it all Saturday at noon at the St. Mark's Navarre Church when there's this funeral for Thule, which is going to have so much love in this room. I mean, it's going to be shocking how much love is going to be in this room for Thule. And anybody out there, you know, who needs a little extra love or is not sure they're getting enough, you show up to this funeral for Thule Kupferberg and you're going to be blown away with this, the love that's going to be in this room. I just can't wait.
Well, that's going to be a great event, and the territory has already been scouted by our friend and also recordist of the Fog Sound of Thule, the late David Nolan. And
yeah.
I swear to God, I got to stop going to church so much.
Yeah, well, you know, it's I always love when Jewish guys, you know, have a funeral in a church. And I remember, like, when my son was married in that church. Baruch Israel, our son's name, was married in that church, and he had a Jewish friend of mine, Judge, marry him. So that's a great church to, like, be in for good days or sad days. That's always a great place to be, and one of the legendary buildings of New York City.
Steve, what are you up to? I know you recently did the nonviolent executions. Are you working on
that? I do that from time to time. I just did a wonderful poetry reading at the Vision Festival. And I perform a lot on hip-hop night, one of the hip-hop nights at the New Eureka Poets Cafe for 15 years. And it's a great experience for me because it's a young hip-hop crowd, and they go crazy to me because, yo, what's up? I'm real and representing, and they respond to me like that. So that's these events that I do twice a month. Always look forward to, you know, like intergenerational stuff. And since our son has been on the hip-hop scene for the last 20 years, he got me to be part of it, and it's a great part of my life to be, you know, me as a guy who's been performing theater for 50 years, also performing on the hip-hop scene. That's the big buzz in my life right now.
That's Steve Ben Israel, and I'm Robert Knight, and you're listening to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York. And Steve, you have the last word, a thought for Thule.
The thought for Thule always is a toast to the future. May it come back.
Steve Ben Israel, thank you so much. I'll be seeing you at the memorial.
Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our conversation with the late actor, poet, composer, comedian, hip-hop performer, philosopher, performance artist, Stephen Ben Israel, who succumbed overnight at his home to a long illness. Before that, Ray Bradbury as well. We'll have more at midnight on Earthwatch. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced by Thiago Perozzo. We'd like to hear from you. Comments, tips, suggestions, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org, theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.